The book is The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser. Chapter The Last. Gloom hung in dank folds o'er the spectral castle on lonely Octopus Rock. Gloom so thick, d'ye see, that it seemed to ooze through the battlements and drip down the sheer walls like treacle. No moon peeped through the lowering cloud rack, no faintest glimmer relieved the inky dark, save for the lanterns on the score of galleons riding in the rock-bound harbor, the guard-room lamp beaming above the grim castle gateway, the rays from a dozen crenellated windows in the massive keep, the flare of a match as a sentry had a crafty smoke, the woof of a chip-pan fire in the cookhouse. Oh, all right. The place was positively ablaze with light, and when the moon suddenly came out, you could see for miles. Satisfied? It was still pretty dark in the corners, anyway. Aye, but 'twas still a night, without wind, save in the great banqueting hall where Enchilada the Chamberlain was making a right pig of himself on chili con carne. No breeze ruffled the fetid waters or the octopus pool beneath the great iron cage in which Black Sheba lay captive, nor whiffled the pale candle flame by which Lady Vanity was gamely trying to pick the ponderous lock of her tower prison with a bent hair clip, nor cooled the perspiration on Hattie McDaniel's brow as she ministered to yet another of Mellifluous screaming tantrums, nor rippled the black velvet waters far out to sea where, unless we're imagining it, dim shadows loom in the murk, as of some dark presence drawing nearer, with faintest creak of cord and timber, and on the air the thinnest whisper of that wild sea march of long ago. No, it may be fancy, fading into silence over the face of empty ocean. Aye, so haste we back to gloomy banquet chamber, where Enchilada is on to the cheese and tacos, stuffing uneasily with piggy-eyed furtive glances at the table-head where, throned in his great chair, sat the hideous Dunlardo, a nightmare figure in crimson silk which matched the ribbon round the scaly neck of the Gila monster, purring on his lap. Enchilada didn't fancy the broody way the viceroy was stroking his ghastly pet and rolling his dentures in awful contemplation. Nor was he crazy about Lardo's occasional habit of crushing a priceless wine glass in his hairy paw, heedless of the wine, blood, and broken glass which fell into his trifle. Heedless, too, incidentally, of the matched sets of glasses which he and other 17th-century villains were forever breaking up in moments of crisis. Snapped stems, broken bowls, shattered goblets, crockery all over the floor. They didn't give a damn, and never a thought for the butlers who had to clear up and order replacements. But crisis was there now, for suddenly the viceroy broke the silence with a great blare of crazy laughter, swept the Gila monster aside, and sprang to his feet, bawling, "I'm getting married in the morning!" "Ding dong!" yelped Enchilada sycophantically, stifling a guilty burp. "Terrific imitation, boss! If I'd had my eyes closed, I'd have sworn it was Holloway. You want I should get Cougat and the boys for a sing-song?" "Silence, filth!" roared Dunlardo. "I'm proclaiming my nuptials, thou bloated worm! Tomorrow I wed Donna Mellifluous. I'm fed up waiting, and what better way to beguile the time than by honeymooning with that sweet, innocent, tender bloom of maidenhood in these charming surroundings?" He flung out a huge hand at the funereal walls where smoky torches flared, and slobbered crazily, his teeth popping out to bean the bewildered Gila monster. "Well, congratulate yourself, you lucky piece of putrefaction. You're going to be best man." "Gosh, Excellency, I'm speechless with joy and gratitude.
babbled the greaseball, grovelling at Lardo's feet. "It's great news, and I am so happy for you. It couldn't happen to a nicer tyrant." He peeped up, hesitant. "You decided not to wait until after we drenched the Caribbean in heretic blood, huh? Do I detect a reproach, a contradiction even?" screamed the viceroy, looming horribly. "Perhaps you'd care to repeat it to my Gila monster, when I've starved him for a week and sewn you up in a sack together. Munch, munch, munch!" Then his enchilada gibbered and cringed. Lardo plucked him up by his fat neck, glared round as though for eavesdroppers, and grew frighteningly confidential. "Between ourselves, the enchilada, as viceroy to rat, I burn with dark desires. The amount of unavailable nubile talent in this place is driving me crazy. Not only mellifluous, but that sleek spade in the cage and the luscious English peach upstairs." He whimpered pathetically, his pale eyes gleaming. "It's not fair, I tell you. I daren't molest the captives before the wedding, or mellifluous might write whining to Daddy and he'd cancel the match. Think of his fortune, lost to me." He began to weep, mopping his cheeks with the chamberlain's scrubby head. "After we're married, it'll be different. I can go bananas with all three of them, and who cares? Anyway," he leered into Enchilada's sweating face, "dear child though mellifluous is, she needs a lesson such as only a wedding night with me can teach her. Criticize my snakes and spiders, will she? Wait till she looks under our marriage bed."
"Alligators, huh, boss? Genius!" cried the terrified creep. "Say, does the lucky lady know that tomorrow's the big day?"
"I told her before dinner," cackled Lardo. "She swooned with joy, the sweet, ecstatic little pigeon. Oh, I can't wait. Ceremony in the main dungeon, all hung in black crepe. Wedding breakfast, auto-da-fe in the afternoon, tea, cream cakes, and crisps. Feed the garrison defaulters into the octopus pool in the evening. Light buffet supper, and then..." He swung the chamberlain round his head in mad frenzy. "The bridal suite in an oubliette, next to the torture chamber. Mustn't neglect our work, even on honeymoon, must we? Quick, let's leave Lardo's jolly stag night and plunge down castle wall and cliff to the octopus pool, where Sheba's grim iron cage swings creaking o'er murky waters, a swirl with tentacled crawlies, just waiting for the bolts in the cage floor to be slipped so that the occupant can drop in on them for dinner. For a fortnight, they've had nothing but the odd bit of banana peel falling through the bars, and can't wait to sink their beaks in the human dainty so tantalizingly close above them. For these are man-eating monsters, long since extinct, except in sensational fiction. But they're patient, like Sheba. For 2 weeks, the dusky demon has endured hell of blazing sun and lashing storm, sustained only by bananas and rainwater, enduring the makeup jars absent-mindedly dropped by mellifluous from Vanity's window, and the ribaldries of brutal guards who ogled her undress and occasionally tried to get fresh through the bars. Now she lies feigning sleep with every nerve alert, for she has caught the drift of that distant sea march on the night air, and instinct tells her it's now or never, as through slitted eyes she watches the solitary sentry lounging on the ledge beside which her cage swings, drowsing as he puffs on his surreptitious cigarillo.
"Got a smoke for a nice girl, amigo?"
The sentry started at the throaty drawl. Two great amber eyes gleamed at him in the moonlight, and a shapely black form pressed ardently against the bars.
"I'd do "Anything for a couple of drags," she hissed. "You can even have my autograph for your kid sister." "Hmm?" And she pursed her lips kiss-wise at him. "Caramba," thought the sentry. "They don't build them like that in Barcelona." Was this the wild hellcat who had driven off his lewd advances with raking nails? He leaned forward to paw cautiously, but Sheba writhed back, purring. "Ah, naughty. No smoky, no touchy," and winked wickedly. Well, we could have told him to pack in the nicotine habit on the spot and holler for the guard, but being mere dumb peasant, he reasoned that iron bars were protection enough and held out his cigarillo, panting eagerly. Sheba caressed it from his fingers, inhaled luxuriously, bazoomed up against the bars again. He lunged, leering, and fingers of black steel clamped on his throat, dragging him from the edge to kick helplessly at empty air. Her free hand plucked out his rapier, and grinning wolfishly into his empurpled face, she slowly thrust forward. The sentry shuddered grotesquely, and with a hissed, "Come and get it, pussies!" she let him drop into the pool below. Splash, swirl of blood-stained water, deep octopodal belch. And silence. That was the easy bit, thought Sheba. The tricky part was to slip the floor bolts while clinging to the side bars with the rapier in her teeth, and then, when the floor swung down on its hinges, deluging the pool with used banana peel and leaving Sheba with nothing between her and the octopus-infested depths, to lower herself out of the cage at full stretch of her arms, feet cringing just above the water as she felt, in horrid imagination, the slimy touch of tentacles on her skin, then to swing out and up, snatching at the bars from the outside, clutching, slipping, clinging for her life, and then scrambling up the cage side to the safety of the roof. For a minute, she lay panting and shivering, thinking 6 out of 6 for technical merit, but not more than 4 for presentation. She gazed eagerly seaward, across the rock-bound bay where the Spanish galleons rode, but nothing moved on the dim water. Had she been wrong? No, she could feel it out yonder, and the sea march was whispering in her ears. Wow, she thought. Suppose it's him, in person, hasting to my side. Or to the side of that blonde cream puff up there, who's been slathering herself with Helena Rubinstein like there's no tomorrow. Nay, it must not be. The sable sea queen ground pearly teeth. Her eyes blazed tawny sparks, and it took another digestive rumble from the depths of the octopus pool to recall her to her perilous situation. Time to get under cover, and where better than her own boudoir 200 feet above, at the other end of the rusty, creaking chain from which the cage hung suspended. Little had she ever dreamed, in the carefree days when she had leaned from her casement, dropping debris, insults, and poisoned snacks on her own caged captives, that a time would come when she would have to climb up that dizzy height, starkers, with her mouthful of rapier. With a wistful sigh, the swart Aphrodite clenched the blade in her teeth, took a deep breath, flexed her lovely nostrils, and started up the chain, hand over hand. With a startled squeak, Lady Vanity jerked her bent hair clip from the keyhole and sprang back. Someone was unlocking the door. For a wild moment she wondered if it was Mellifluo, intent on a midnight feast, for since Blood's escape, the dainty Hidalga had been a frequent visitor, drawn, despite her jealous rivalry, by that sisterhood which links Deb to Deb, and many a snack of sardines and cocoa had they shared in giggling gossip, Mellifluo discoursing of hijinks in the convent dorm, and Vanity describing how she had bundled the Rodin goalkeeper into the net, ball and all, in the last minute with the scores tied. They had also played Leviathan, Master Hobbs' forerunner of
monopoly. But it couldn't be Mellifluo. There had been no sound of drugged sentries crashing to the floor of the passage. Who then? Blue orbs wide, rose lips parted, our heroine clasped her filmy robe about her, glanced in the mirror, adjusted a curl, flipped the betraying hair clip deftly into a flower pot, and recoiled as the door opened to reveal Enchilada. And not just Enchilada, but Enchilada panic-stricken with a proposition so bizarre that Vanity did a fluttering double-take. Me? A bridesmaid? I? Art surely loco, Sir Chamberlain, or legless quite? Why, whose nuptials? Oh, she gasped, discerning. You don't mean Lardo is going to make Mellifluo jump off the dock? Oh, the poor little twerp, how grisly!
You better believe it, signorita, chattered the plump chamberlain. His excellency has commanded full rehearsal within the hour, with you as bridesmaid and me as best man, and everything's going haywires. I have no ring. The boss's wedding teeth are nowhere to be found. The Inquisition choir don't know the words of apple blossom time. And I think, he burst into tears, the Gila Monster is going to have pups. Oh, what shall I do? If you fail me, I shall be blamed, and he will fling me to the octopoodles.
But I can't be Mellifluo's bridesmaid. I'm C of E, protested Vanity. Certes, you want a lady of the Roman persuasion.
In this place, wailed Enchilada, the only other female creature is that bloody Gila Monster.
What of the blackamoor pirate, she who is so cruelly encaged over the octothingies, and serve her right? I don't know if she's a Catholic, but she'd look smashing in white.
A voodoo bridesmaid? Please, signorita, don't give me a hard time. It can only be you, and all is arranged. I have priest, can give you crash course, special dispensations, confirmations, you name it. You'll be shooting left-footed before breakfast.
Renounce my faith? Never. I'd sooner eat mud. The dauntless English rose quivered to her full 5'5", hand outflung in a gesture that ordered St. Augustine straight to the pavilion.
All right, so Daddy only goes to church at harvest festivals, and I'm sorry, God, for eating sweets at prayers and reading poo in confirmation class, but never shall I bow the knee to idolatry and chance it. She began to sing Land of Hope and Glory in a clear, girlish soprano, while the distracted chamberlain flung himself pleading at her feet.
Please, signorita, only think. The wedding woodcut will be in all the papers, and you will be recognized, and Don Lardo will have to release you. But if you don't play, who knows you are here? A horrid fate will overtake you, and your papa and friends none the wiser. Please, signorita, I beg. See, I smooch your tootsies in entreaty.
Make thee mightier yet, concluded Vanity defiantly. Stop it, you clot! What is it about my toes, she wondered, that gets men going? Pew, blood, and now you? Jolly odd! But chuck it, Fats, for I'll not yield to— But hark! From the corridor without came a rhythmic thumping of drugged sentries hitting the deck. The door crashed open, and on the threshold Mellifluo paused dramatically, hair distraught, an appearance streaming wildly. She saw Enchilada crouched in supplication at Vanity's feet, and immediately jumped to the wrong conclusion.
"Not you, too!" she shrilled. "The greaseball is proposing. Ah, kick him in the slats, proud Vanity. Give him a touch of the old Cheltenham body slam, isn't it? Would that I could do the same to my persecutor, the disgusting Lardo, who comes even now to claim me for his bride. But I will kill myself first."
"Don't panic,"
cried Vanity. "'Tis but a rehearsal, and if the main event depends on having me as a bridesmaid, Lardo can scratch it off his card right now. Get that enchilada, then hie thee to thy vile master, and tell him—"
"Tell him yourself!"
moaned the chamberlain. "Listen!"
From the depths of the castle boomed a crazy, brazen voice, echoing up stone stairway and a long vaulted passage, loosening plaster and shaking the very walls. The Mr. Universe calendar fluttered at its moorings, and one of the stuffed Spanish heads fell off the paneling.
"Enchilada!"
The voice, not the stuffed head, bawled.
"Where are you, corpulent vermin? I'm waiting, enchilada, for you and that heretic slut, to say nothing of my bride, my wedding teeth, the apple-blossom time sheet music, and a vet for the Gila monster. 45 seconds to rehearsal, enchilada, which is about twice as long as you'll take to fall screaming from the battlements if I have to come looking for you. 40 seconds and counting!"
With shuddering sob, Mellifluous slammed the door.
"I must hide. Ah, conceal me, Vanity Carissima. He may not think to look for me here."
"Nay, why should he, with a passage full of stoned guards outside the door?" snapped Vanity. "Stay, could we revive them, think you, and send them about some errand? What didst zonk them with, child?"
"How do I know? Some drug which my maid get from her pusher. Strychnine, she call it."
"Golly, that's torn it. We must both hide. Nay, such castle as this must a hidden passage, priest's hole, whatever. Thou, enchilada!"
"Please, senoritas, it's no use. If you defy him, ah, Jesus Maria is coming."
"Time!"
boomed the distant brazen voice, with hideous peal of laughter. "Prepare for take-off, enchilada!" Then he was bawling commands, and they heard the menacing tramp of guardsmen hastening to follow their dread master as he came ravening upstairs in search of his prey. Mellifluous shrieked with dismay.
"All is lost, dead. Ah, but he shall never possess me. It's suicide time. I shall fling myself from the window onto the cruel rocks below and cheat him of his lordly triumph."
She streaked to the window, leaped to the sill, and stood poised, holding her nose for the jump, ere Vanity could stop her.
"Farewell, sweet Vanity,"
she enunciated with some difficulty, "and if you think we're going to attempt a nose-blocked Spanish accent, you're mistaken.
Adios, and may you find happiness with your yummy divine scrumptious Avery. Ah, ben mi amore, I shall never—"
"Eek!"
The lissome figure tottered on the sill, gaped downward, and sprang back into the room like a startled budgie, great dark eyes wide with amazement.
"Vanity," she squeaked, "there is someone climbing up the chain to your window."
Which is as climactic a moment as we could wish, to zoom out and away from Octopus Rock, leaving Vanity and Mellifluous clinging to each other as they gazed down from the sill at the dim form writhing up the creaking chain out of the dark depths. And if they'd just happened to look straight out instead of down, they might have seen more matter for a buccaneer midnight, by the powers! For far out on the dark water something is moving indeed. It wasn't our imagination, do you see? Nay, those tall black shadows on the face of the deep are things palpable and charged with menace, surging in towards Octopus Rock from out of the tropic night, and ye may hear the wild sea march singing through their shrouds as they come. 1, 2, 3 great ships with canvas spread, but nary a light among them, save the faint glow at the binnacle of each, where stoop the tight-lipped commanders, their eyes fixed ahead to scan the stark outline of rock and castle a bare half-league away, and the dark loom of the harbour-mouth through which glitter the lights of the dons at anchor.
aboard the first ship. A whispered exchange by the wheel.
Right, Captain. Got everything? Rapier, brace of barkers, dagger, snuff box, clean kerchief. I'm carrying a couple spares. Deodorant and a boxy wig just in case. How's the one you got on? Stuck down all right?
Gummed to perfection, halfling. Nay, but my cursed boots do pinch exquisitely. Ha! Haply we'll find replacements, a rare soft cord of a neat's hide in Lardo, his wardrobe. Dead men's boots they shall be, Goliath, when I have sped that monstrous bastard to last account.
Attaboy, skipper. Here, think we can pull it off, though?
Aye, can we, imp? Godso shall be such exploit this night as shall live in sea history, when they clink their cans on Plymouth Hoe and Severnside, and talk o' Drake at Nombre, Morgan at Maracaibo, and Flynn i' the Warner's tank. Then shall they also roar a rouse for Black Bilbo that led the storm o' Octopus Rock, saha! Aye, zooks, the deadliest blade of the Brotherhood, they'll say, and the best dressed. In the hold of the second ship. Easy, old 'un, with they matches. There's 40 ton of powder close packed about us, d'ye see, and it ain't non-inflammable.
40 ton calico, ha? Har, har. Enough to light more crackers by the powers wi' a curse belike and damn all, say I. Aye, and to blow the dagos to hell and gone, so shall they speak of the harbour at Octopus Rock as Firebeard's beard, looky, that flamed and roared and consumed bloody Lardo and every bottom of his cursed fleet.
Nearly, old son, nearly. But harkee now, when thy fuses be lit, and this old revenge has driven to the very heart of the Spanish squadron, then every light above deck must gleam of a sudden, and thou and the lads blaze defiance at the dons, so shall they bring their ships close about to grapple and board.
And when revenge doth blow a 40 ton, 'twill hoist the buggers nigh to kingdom come. Rat, burn, damn, and devour me else. Aye, shall have an utter a fee of their own.
But when they be all flaming in glory, and we victorious,
then, calico brother, we take pardons, huh? And swallow the anchor like Bonny Ann. Sure, 'twill be strange, that with curse and belike, do you see?
Aye, strange, old rogue. So, seize thy hand, camarado, and good fortune.
On thou, messmate, and damn all dons and honest men, har, har.
While aboard the third ship.
So there's no call to get old la-dee-da with me, Blackleg Avery. I'm telling you, the executive totally and arbitrarily exceeded their powers in giving command to a non-union individual. And unless you're prepared to sign this application for a temporary probationary card, I shall be forced to black this entire operation, see?
A fig for thy card, sirrah! What, in 5 minutes we'll be at grips with the cursed dons? Steer small, quartermaster. No smoking forward. Bosun, take that man's name. Now look, you. I've explained that as captain I'm part of management.
And therefore confined to poop operations, and not entitled to engage in tradesmen's activities, to wit, boarding, cutting, thrusting, swinging on ropes, discharging firearms, storming fortifications, looting, pillaging.
Don't be ridiculous. I'm the hero. Stand by, men, and when I cry, grapnels away, I want to see good clean throws where bags are follow through. Ready, trumpet of corn gold? Will you get off my quarterdeck, you Welsh pest?
Oh, a lockout, is it? Comrades, we got a right fascist here. I'm not coming headscarf in hand to you, so...
Hit him, Blood, will you? Thanks. Right, chaps, any minute now. All set, pikes. Ready, rapiers. Stand by, cutlasses. Quiet, please. Settle down, everyone. I want this done in one take, remember? So when I shout action... We can't deny him a close-up. There he is, for almost the last time, one hand on the rigging,
profile cleaving the night air, spray dashing against smiling teeth, keen gray eyes and shirt ruffles dancing in unison. He flourishes gallant blade to his followers, who skip hurriedly back out of harm's way, laughs with carefree confidence as he pops a sea-legs pill twixt eager lips, and claps blood on the shoulder, possibly out of comradeship, but more probably to make sure he doesn't sneak off at the crucial moment. For now they're rocketing in on the last lap, Frantic Frog and Laughing Sandbag, to launch their crews in surprise assault on the castle, do you see? While the Plymouth Corporation's revenge, a floating bomb with a skeleton crew, will add to the general gaiety by exploding amongst the close-packed galleons. A mighty hazard, says you. They want their heads examined, which they undoubtedly did, just like Piet Hein and Pierre Legrand and Howard and Drake with their improbable fireships at Gravelines, and Morgan with his crazy stratagem at Maracaibo, and all those other mad adventurers who apparently couldn't count, and whose ghostly, outnumbered men-o'-war and caravels and long ships hung like wraiths on the heels of the buccaneers gliding in towards Octopus Rock.
"Who can it be?" cried Mellifluo, window hanging breathlessly as the chain creaked and swung with the approach of the mysterious climber. "A burglar? A human fly? Ah, vanity, perhaps it's some gallant officer from the galleons who has seen you from afar and is climbing mad with love for you, and he will rescue us in the nick of time."
"Oh, don't be so soppy, Mellifluo," blushed Vanity. "'Tis far more like to be someone who's been gated, sneaking in after breaking bounds. I mean, who could fall in love from that distance? He couldn't even see me."
"He could, I say," snapped Mellifluo, "with a telescope, easy."
Their speculations were interrupted by a thunderous din, as of 11 zinc baths toppling in the corridor without, followed by a metallic pinging not unlike a pin-table, noises which the terrified girls instantly diagnosed as a viceroy in full ceremonial armor, tripping over a pile of drugged guards, his false teeth flying out and rebounding from stone walls. With a shriek of alarm, Enchilada dived beneath the bed, and Vanity sped to the door and shot the bolts home only an instant before some massive object, Dunlardo's skull, in fact, crashed against the panels. The great door creaked and shuddered as he beat on it with steel gauntlets. In case you're wondering why Dunlardo should be armed cap-a-pie for a wedding rehearsal, it was because his family always got married in full martial panoply, a quaint custom dating back to the Crusades, when Starco Baluna, first of the line, lost his spanners at the Siege of Acre. But it's rather a long story, and the fact is we want Lardo in armor for this scene anyway.
"I know they're in there," he bellowed. "Enchilada, you maggot, what have you done with my betrothed? Is this your idea of a stag night practical joke? I know your zany sense of humor, you mad barrel of fun, you. Well, I'm not a bit angry," he screamed, tearing great lumps of wood from the door. "And if you open up, we'll say no more about it. At least you won't, because I'm going to nail your tongue to the back of your head."
The door shuddered on its hinges, and the helpless girls did another panic-stricken cling.
"What can we do?" moaned Mellifluo. "Hey, could we take Enchilada hostage and threaten to cut his throat unless they promise us transport to Panama?"
"That'll send Lardo scurrying," cried Vanity sarcastically. "Ah, they're taking axes to the door. Quickly, onions, to the chain, outside the window. If someone can climb up, perchance we may clamber down. 'Tis perilous chance, but our only hope." A dreadful throaty chuckle cut her short.
"Feel free. The chain's empty at the moment. After you, ladies."
And with a mocking gesture of invitation, Black Sheba slipped over the sill, rapier in hand. Mellifluous clutched Flawless brow, but Vanity was equal to this new crisis and made an instinctive grab for the one remaining pot of Helen Rubinstein on the dressing table. Sheba snarled and flung her sword with diabolical nicety, pinning the English girl's sleeve to the timber. "Hands off, honky!" Sheba bounded to the table, jerked free her rapier, and with a malicious chuckle tossed the precious goo pot through the window. Vanity wailed with dismay. "Oh, spiteful! 'Twas the last a discontinued line!" "Who needs it?" Sheba thrust out her lovely ebony chin. 2 weeks I rotted in yon foul cage, yet mark my complexion, its creamy softness, its warm glow of vibrant tissue. Saw ye ever such satin perfection, ha?" Huh? Vanity marked in wonder. "Why, 'tis true. Nay, but to what?" "To what but Dame Nature's own abundant oils and vitamins," crowed the Sea Queen. "Mashed banana, sparingly applied twice daily, and laved clean with pure rainwater, so a pox on their apothecary gunge. Aye, and not for facial beauty alone," she pirouetted, gleaming nudely. "How's that for all-over skin tone?" "Terrific! But, dark Medusa, we are beset. Dunlardo rages without, intent upon our shame. Aid us, for pity's sake!" "Good luck to him," mocked Sheba, rummaging for clothes in the wardrobe. "He can have you, and welcome. And yon green sick Spanish pansy, too. 'Twill be his last fling, afore the Brotherhood lowers the boom on him." She was whipping on shirt and breeches of familiar scarlet, chuckling wickedly as she drew on her long boots. "Take comfort from that, dainty Vanity. Thy ravishment shall be speedily avenged." She sped to the mirror and tried on a picture hat with a green plume, adjusting it doubtfully.
"Captivity has driven her mad," cried Mellifluous. "Black fool, who is going to do any avenging once that door is down? Enchilada under the bed, maybe?"
"Lardo'll give you the works as well as us," urged Vanity. "And that color combination stinks, incidentally." "Ha!" Sheba glared at the mirror. "What's wrong with green? Clashes like maracas. If you can't match the red, forget it, right, Mellifluous?
Ah, see where the door splinters."
Sheba, with an oath, tried a yellow plume, biting her lip. "Nay, 'twill have to do." She snatched up a rapier and leaped cat-like towards the door. "Get a blade, fool, if you would save your milky hide, from the rack yonder. Canst use a tuck, ha?" Huh? "Oh, gosh, sorry. Didn't take fencing at school. Haven't got a hockey stick, have you?"
"Jesu! And you think yourself fit mate for Long Ben Avery? The chest, then. Pistols and shot. Haste, Wayface. If we can hold them off, the Brotherhood shall be here anon. I've had their sea-drums in my ears this hour past, I tell you. Speed!"
Little though she had expected to find herself embroiled in such a boudoir battle, Sheba was raring to go. She whirled a satin hanging round her left arm, and, as an axe head, bashed a great hole in the upper door, and Lardo's frightful clock appeared, a grin with bestial fury. The dusky wildcat yelled with glee, and thrust like striking snake, ploughing a great gash in his cheek. Howling, the viceroy recoiled, but a rush of his followers beat down half the door, and furious clang of blades followed as Sheba held them in that narrow space, thrusting, leaping, taunting, and doing some neat matador work with her satin shield. Vanity scrambled for the pistols, and presently the chamber was areek with powder and smoke, and booming with discharge as she blew holes in the floor, ceiling, and dressing-table mirror, while Mellifluous lent valiant support by climbing on a chair to spot targets and shout out the ranges and elevations to the blonde pistolier.
"Take 'em alive!"
hollered Lardo from the back of the press, dashing gore from his face with his steel gauntlet.
"Yaw! Blood! My blood! God, if she's ruined my looks, I'll roast her alive! On, you scum!
Bring out my bride unscathed, and you can have a gangbang with the other two. Down with them, sort them out, or we'll never get this wedding rehearsal underway. Laggards, cowards, have at them. They're only a pack of frustrated feminists.
His men flung themselves reluctantly into the half-blocked doorway to meet the triple threat of Sheba's dazzling point, Vanity's artillery. She was getting the range now, and several shots hit the wall within yards of the doorway, one even grazing the lintel. And the hail of missiles which Mellifluo, screaming with rage, was hurling from the dressing table, skilled from infancy in hitting a running Hattie McDaniel with anything from wooden blocks to dinky toys, the fiery Hidalgo rained scent bottles, brushes, and makeup jars on her countrymen with devastating effect. Shrieks of the stricken mingled with cries for stretcher-bearers and impassioned peace slogans as the threshold became a shambles of blood, hand cream, and Chanel No. 5. But it couldn't have lasted. Sheba's steel strength weakened by a fortnight on bananas. Whate'er their cosmetic properties, they just don't provide the roughage. Was flagging. Panting magnificently, she lunged to bury her point in a Spanish torso, felt the blade snap, and fell back with a defiant sob and a sword 4 inches long. Vanity, startled off her aim, shot an opponent plumb between the eyes. Mellifluo was reduced to hurling the Mr. Universe calendar. It was the end. Beauteous but beaten, our indomitable trio had had it. With howls of gloat, the brutal soldiery, urged on by the unspeakable Lardo, gathered themselves for the final rush. Heavens, can nothing save them? Of course it can. Listen. Aye, in that fatal moment of defeat and despair, they heard it. Borne from afar through the night air on wings of hope and triumph, the gathering rumble of the Warner Brothers fanfare, and on its heels the stirring double flourish of the corn-gold trumpet. Woomf, dump, da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, followed by the thunder of broadsides as the frantic frog and laughing sandbag, heeling out of the mist, poured their storm of shot and flame into the harbor fort and the sea gate of the castle itself. The tower shook to the fury of the cannonade, twice and thrice repeated, and as it died echoing away came a sound even more terrible, as of hordes of desperate, cutlass-waving ruffians swinging recklessly to and fro in the rigging, pouring wildly in and out of hatches, leaping from the bulwarks, screaming with shock as they landed in shallow water, and finally storming up the beaches, yelling that dreaded buccaneer war cry wherewith Spanish mothers were wont to fright their babes. You go ahead, Jack. I'll beach the boat. The Spanish garrison were taken completely unawares. They always are. It's part of their training. They responded perfectly. While the officers leaped from their chairs, overturning their wine cups, the men gaped blearily. A sergeant in a morion ran about shouting, Andalusian rhubarb! And a small drummer began an impersonation of Buddy Rich in ill-fitting tights. In seconds, stairs and doorways were jammed with men in helmets carrying pikes, while a file of arquebusiers knelt down in agitation and opened fire at a blank wall. Into this brilliantly choreographed chaos the buccaneers swept like a tidal wave, and guess who was at their head, in white shirt and ruffles, lithely skewering everything in his path, pausing only to point with muscular forearm and cry, On, on, my lads! Feet, 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 school, now let it out! Before bounding sideways onto an outside staircase to trip a couple of sword-waving idiots coming down, Pink a third, who gets to do a slow artistic death roll into the courtyard, pause for a grimly smiling profile shot in shadow, and then plow upstairs in search of Vanity. Down at the sea gate, Bilbo was in equally spectacular form, making kebabs of 3 foemen in quick succession and fleering elegantly while performing the showy trick of taking snuff and discharging a pistol with 1 hand simultaneously, the least lapse of concentration, and his opponent would have been struck by a pinch of best repare, while Bilbo got a pistol ball up his nose. But the filibuster captain managed things to perfection. The Don went down, Bilbo fluttered kerchief to nostril, Goliath squealed admiringly, "Four in a row, ba-boom!" And the men of the Laughing Sandbag overwhelmed the gate in celebration. At the same moment, the harbor fort succumbed to an excited flood of pirates in striped jerseys and red pom-poms, yelling, "Vive la différence!" and headed by the galooned and prancing figure of Happy Dan Pugh. A restful sea voyage and course of strongly voiced consonants had restored him to comparative sanity. His nasalized vowels and sweeping épée drove the Spaniards like sheep. He prattled with fluent confidence of prefixed verbs and mesures théométriques, and when he slashed down the Spanish flag with an exultant cry of, "I have risen me," his Gallic followers wept for joy, and only the more cautious spirits felt he was tempting providence. Down in the harbor itself was sheer panic. The crews of the galleons lined the rails, pointing and holding on to the shrouds in disorganized fashion, while their superiors stood open-mouthed on their poops, fists on hips, crying, "Caramba! Valencia! And Granada!" in well-bred amazement. And as trumpets blared and orders were shouted, none marked the black shape of the Plymouth Corporation's Revenge, gliding into their midst like very shadow o' doom, until all its lights went on at once, and it hove to, blazing like Blackpool front, while its skeleton crew leaned over the side, sounding rattles, deflating poo-poo cushions, waggling their fingers beside their ears, and waving intimate garments at the Spanish ships. Firebeard was conspicuous with his exploding whiskers and lewd gestures. "Ha, ha, dagoes!" he bellowed. "King Philip's of Faroe, d'ye see? Knott's Forest won. Real Madrid nil, belike. Latin's a lousy lovers wi' a curse. Ha, ha!" Enraged, the Spanish captains instantly ordered their ships to close on the insolent intruder, and in a trice half the squadron was close-packed round the pirate ship, while the skeleton crew were nipping smartly down to a jolly-boat neath the stern, Firebeard landing head first, wi' a warning. And as the unsuspecting Dons flooded aboard, the jolly-boat scooted for safety as hard as it could row, with Calico Jack at the tiller. High on a stone staircase in the castle, Avery was disposing of a platoon of sword-waggling opponents when he heard the cataclysmic boom of the Plymouth Corporation's Revenge's explosion. Pausing in his parry of five simultaneous thrusts, he had time for a hearty chuckle ere swinging to safety via conveniently hanging curtain. With a flick of his wrist, he thrust a chest of drawers down the steps, sweeping his enemies away in confusion, and hastened to an embrasure from which he could look down on the panorama of courtyard and harbor and tot up the score. Despite the good write-up we've been giving the buccaneers so far, it wasn't a totally satisfactory picture that met the captain's clear, gray-eyed gaze. True, the harbor was a roaring sea of flame, with half the galleons burning in a veritable holocaust of special effects, but the other half were making tracks for the harbor entrance in good order and blasting holes in the Laughing Sandbag and Frantic Frog, which the pirates had carelessly left untenanted when they stormed ashore. Making a mental note to have someone on a fizzer for that dereliction of duty, our heroes switched focus to the land battle, and his knuckles beat faster, and his ruffles rose in alarm, as he saw that the buccaneer attack was running out of steam. Here, that's bad. To the untrained eye, it was the usual torch-lit melee of bodies heaving lethargically to and fro, but Avery could read the telltale signs. Spaniards were falling, screaming from the walls, at far below the standard rate. No pile of surrendered weapons was visible. The music was nowhere like reaching a triumphant climax. Cries of "Quarter!" were just as frequent in English as in Spanish, and his lips tightened in anger. Several knots of pirates had fallen out for a quick smoke, and in one sheltered corner a surreptitious brew-up.
with muttered exclamation, he was about to rush down and turn the tide single-handed, when his marrow froze and his hair congealed, as from somewhere overhead there echoed the shrill wail of a woman. Whether in agony, danger, disappointment, or screaming tantrum, he could not tell. It's always difficult, with battle finales, to keep tabs on all the principals, and while the lads have been doing their thing, we have lost track of events at the top of the tower, where we left Les Girls on the point of capture by Donlardo's crew. The Spaniards were about to barge in, you recall, when the pirate onslaught froze the scene. Then it all happened. Sheba leaped to the paneling, pressed a button, and vanished into a secret passage with a sharp click. Mellifluo swooned and was dragged out to the cruel embrace of beastly Lardo. Vanity screamed, and Enchilada, who'd learned a thing or two in his career as a court functionary, shot from beneath the bed like a flying profiterole, and with a squeal of "To the bathroom!" pointed the way to sanctuary for our heroine. Vanity got inside just in time to see him vanish behind the shower curtain. Then she had slammed the door in the Spaniards' faces, the engaged sign shot up, and with all hell breaking loose outside, the viceroy ordered his men downstairs to lend the garrison a hand. Fine, that's Vanity out of harm's way, and the stage is set for Lardo and Avery to run into each other somewhere on a lonely stairway or in a great shadowy torch-lit hall, exchange long, slow, burning looks, revoltingly contorted in deep-breathing hatred on one side, steely-eyed and grim, smiling resolution on t'other. Bandy remarks like, "Tho, English dog, you'll yap defiance at the finest swordsman in Spain, will you?" And, "All right, Lardo, we'll see if your blade's as nimble as your tongue. I've no doubt it's cleaner. Slash a few candles in half and get down to business." Sorry, that's not what happened. Avery, hearing that piercing shriek, Mellifluo coming up for air, actually, was making for the stairs like a frenzied whippet, but got caught up not with Lardo, but with a spare bunch of guards, the ones who are forever emerging at the double from archways and passages with shouts of, "Ha! Jumble!" whenever the hero is operating solo in the enemy HQ and needs some time to himself. So it was back downstairs again for our Ben, with thrust and parry and flying furniture, while Lardo, with his limp and lovely burden. He wasn't the best swordsman in Spain, or even in Madrid W1. Huge, ugly, disgustingly strong, yes, but strictly fourth division when it came to stamp and slash, saha. And he was chicken, too. One quick look from a window at the carnage beneath, and he was making for the back stairs with Mellifluo in a fireman's lift, his one object to scuttle out the back way, get aboard his private flagship, the Santa Umbriago, which was round the corner in a secluded creek, and make for the tall timber. For aboard the Santa Umbriago was all his loot, including the multi-millions of Pew's treasure in used gold coins, that fabulous hoard which blood had betrayed, you'll mind. And, speaking of blood, you haven't noticed him laying on in the thick of the fight, have you? "Not we," says you, blinking. "Where on earth?" "Even so," says I, "step this way." Deep in the gloomy bowels of Octopus Rock, where walls dripped and all manner of ugle lay underfoot, two figures stole through the odorous dark of the watercress dungeon and paused in indecision where dim-lit passages converged. Harky. "Come on, you old idiot. You were down here long enough to grow fins, so you must know the way up. Take a cast about, rot ye, and if ye land me in another tub of mushroom dung, I'll lose me temper, so I will."
"Oidly-dang-do that away, huh? Nay, perhaps not by yonder stair, eh? Ah, mizzlet, old Saul be confazzled, maister, d'ye see? 'Tis shortage of drippin', ah, sweet nourishin' drippin', as do blunt the senses keen, so it do. So whither, ha! Huh? Let's lay aloft on this tack with a battle de boop."
Blood and Shafto, by the powers! What should this portend? Easy.
Blood, misliking Hard Knocks, yet eager to show well with Vanity in the last act, had sloped off like the skunk he was when the pirates first landed, and with Shafto as guide, had entered by the familiar postern. For Shafto, ye mind, knows where our heroine is confined, and for promise a rich reward, he has engaged to conduct Knavish Tom thither, Blood's reasoning being that if he's the first marine to land, the admiral's daughter may yet be his. Devious type, isn't he? So up they steal, past echoing empty cells, on those fatal back stairs. And you know who's on his villainous way down, don't we? They met with mutual yells of alarm. The hideous viceroy had retained two trusted thugs as bodyguards. But Blood and Shafto had no time to reckon odds, let alone flee. It was swords out and get stuck in. Blood's rapier and Solomon's gardening implements against the three Spanish broadswords, while Mellifluwa assumed the classic pose for spectating heroines, one hand clasped to muslin brow, while the other plucked her marble fichu. Brawl right murderous ensued, for Lardo, armored and berserk with panic, was lethal as a rogue steamroller, bawling and clanging as he unleashed savage swipes which would have cloven our twain in two, or vice versa, had they been less nippy. Blood, parrying desperately, was beaten back by sheer weight, and as Lardo closed with him, a thug let drive at the colonel's undefended flank, but swish thunk came a high-heeled stiletto flung with unerring aim. Well done, Mellifluwa, to pierce the rascal's sword-arm. As Blood broke free, Solomon's secateurs found a gap in the second thug's guard. Blood completed the good work with punto reverso, ole, and a hack on the shins. And Lardo, the yellow hound, pausing only to scoop up case containing credit cards and traveler's checks, snatched Mellifluwa under one huge arm and legged it incontinently, with the Irish adventurer and the ragged galoot in hot pursuit. Lardo boobed. Fleeing regardless, he was making for the front of the castle, and his mad rush carried him out onto a balcony overlooking the flaming harbor. Trapped, he turned at bay, his nightmare features glaring horribly, and as rapier and secateurs drove in for the kill, the craven viceroy sank to the pits of caddish behavior. His steel fingers closed on his lovely hostage's slender throat, and his dentures gnashed in fiendish threat. Back, back, I say, or the frail geth hurve. Another step, and bye-bye, vertebrae.
Oh, gasped Mellifluwa piteously.
Hoidelegling, cried compassionate Shafto. Pack it in, Lardo, and I'll try to get you off with 99 years, shouted Blood, white-lipped. But the viceroy gibbered with mad laughter, and his free hand sought the great rusty chain which hung hard by the balcony down the sheer castle wall to Sheba's cage far beneath. One step, and his foot was on the iron links.
"Stay me at your peril!" he snarled. "Once aboard the chain, I'm immune as I scramble down to safety, for if I fall, she falls with me to manglish death. Ha, ha, ha! I've scored again! Pass me that case of traveller's checks, Irish lout, and then turn to the wall and count 100, and no peeking!"
Tense as an E-string, Blood edged forward, took the case on his sword-point, and cautiously extended it. Straddled twixt balcony and chain, but hampered by Mellifluwa as they hung over the dizzy drop, Lardo opened mailed hand to receive it, and with a mad yell of Froodle-me-zip, Solomon suddenly flung his deadly watering can. Straight as an arrow it sped, clanging resoundingly on the back of Blood's head. He reeled. The case fell. Lardo grabbed at it. Mellifluwa slipped from his grasp and landed, decoratively asprawl, on the balcony coping. Blood lunged and seized her. The viceroy swung out and away on the chain, howling with rage. The tiny rivets on his steel gauntlets popped free under the strain of clutching the rusty links. Plink, 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 plink! The metal glove came apart, and with a hideous scream, the massive armored figure fell, turning over and over, growing smaller and smaller as it plunged down at 32 feet per second into the gloomy depths.
They waited, breathless, Mellifluo swooning in Blood's arms, Solomon chewing his beard and counting, until from far below came the ultimate, almighty clang and splat. Fearfully they peered down and beheld the octopus pool a-churn with horror, and thereafter the tentacled denizens scrambling out with octopodal noises of disgust and slithering hastily across the rocks seaward. But of infamous Lardo naught remained, save shattered dentures on the pool's rim. Ye may think, belike, that with Mellifluo snuggling up to Blood, a new romantic attachment is imminent. After all, he's plucked her from grisly fate, and she's unattached. Sorry again, Blood isn't privy to her old man's bank balance, and anyway, she's too young for him. Disposing her decently on a convenient couch, Tom is hot-foot upstairs again to find Vanity, while Solomon clambers nimbly down the chain to retrieve his fallen watering can, which had ricocheted from the colonel's skull into the void. But what's happening down below, anyway? Faith, but we're in a desperate case, for the sheer weight of numbers of the damned dons is like to turn the scale, d'ye see? The buccaneer detachments, their first fury spent, are barely holding their own against vasty odds as the battle rages across the great courtyard and round the sea gate. The Spaniards, heartened by the rumor that their leader, Don Lardo, has met a timely end, have got their heads down in a really splendid shove, and the pirate pack is like to be heaved off its feet, looky. Ah, them breaks in training, they crafty smokes when all was going well. We'm paying for them now as the dons wheel and take in an inspired foot rush, and the tide of battle rolls inch by inch toward the great sea gate with its looming portcullis, fit scene for desperate last stand by the ragged rabble as the dons press in on them. We'll curse, but they're going game. Black Bilbo, his shoddy finery cut to ribbons, his boots pinching like bedamned, fights like a lean fury in the front rank. Beside him capers Happy Dan, plying lively blade and hissing his vowels through clenched nostrils with no trace of diphthongization. Goliath, his leg in splinters, lies gnashing tiny teeth and biting every Spanish ankle in sight. Firebeard, up from the harbor, his beard a charred wreck, plunges into the melee, roaring and reeking. Calico Jack spits again on his horny hand and swings ponderous cutlass. Solomon Shafto, his secateurs snapped off short, lays on with watering can and pruning knife, and still they give slow ground, the battered remnant of the once mighty brotherhood, their backs to the sea, where the unscathed Spanish galleons are wheeling leisurely toward shore, preparing to take the retreating enemy with grape, and so make an end. Let's face it, the buccaneers are right in it, up to here. Nay, but this can't be, says you. What with vile Lardo slain, Vanity and Mellifluo preserved miraculous, Sheba taking care of herself somewhere, and the lads but a moment since within an ace a glorious victory, it cannot go sour at the last, huh? Can it not, says I. We warned you from the first, remember, that this was no ordinary tale. Happy endings are well enough for the last pages of romance, or the closing reel of spectaculars. But this is not Hollywood. This is Octopus Rock. Even Avery frowned in vexation as he dropped from an embrasure onto the seagate wall. He had disposed of those inconvenient guards upstairs, and now sped nimbly along the wall, dusting off stray Spaniards, launched himself at a torch sconce, and with a series of trapezish swings dropped into the midst of the buccaneer force as it beat its fighting retreat in a choking haze of powder smoke and recriminations. Heedless of the din of battle, the crash of shots and clash of steel, the gloating yells of the Spaniards and the appalling language of the pirates, he demanded situation reports from his commanders. He got them. "We'm beset, do you see?" bellowed Firebeard. "Took fore and aft, burn, rot, and sink them sneaking dons. I despise 'em. They ain't even honest men, damn 'em!"
"'C'est un fact, morbleu!' chortled Happy Dan, executing a neat pas seul and unseeming a passing Spaniard. "'Mais que voulez-vous? C'est la vie! Ha! What do I say, me? Ce n'est pas la vie at all, c'est le mort!' "'And no gainsaying,' growled Calico Jack, his fine white threads begrimed with powder reek. "'We bit off the inch too much this voyage, Long Ben.' And there's an end to it. So shall ye have your way at last, King's man, jeered Bilbo, leaning panting on his black rapier. An end to the Brotherhood. Well, ye has led us to it. Die all, die merrily.
Absolute rot, cried the undaunted Avery. Why, we haven't even started. So what I want to see is a good deal more effort, and less of this defeatist croaking. Why, all we've got to do is knock the stuffing out of these blighters, or even half of them, and the rest will pack in, you'll see. Vive la France, Happy Dan! Give 'em the message, Firebeard! Goliath, you're doing extremely well. Carry on gnashing. All right, Shafto, settle down. The rest of you, get stuck in and hip hip hurrah!
But as the buccaneers roared their derision and fought tooth and nail with their onrushing foes, our hero's jaw tightened with an audible creak, for he could count as well as the next man, and unless he was mistaken, the end was near.
"Bilbo," he said quietly, "just for the record, you're the best swordsman I've ever seen."
"Indeed, Cully," drawled exhausted Bilbo, "I verily believe I am. For see thou, I have never met my master." And he grinned his most vulpine grin and nodded to Avery, "Only my match."
And with that, he laughed and plunged into the fight, his black blade darting, and was lost to sight.
"Rackham," said our hero, his sturdy chin a-quiver with manly apology, "I may have goofed after all. Sorry about the pardons."
The big man nodded with an odd, slow smile.
"And we never claim 'em, camarado," quoth he. "Yet shall we have our quittance here, one way or t'other."
And that, as the tide of battle surged around the sea gate, should have been it. But, of course, it wasn't. For as someone protested a couple of minutes ago, we haven't come 400 pages near as damn it to have everything fall apart in the last chapter. Nay, there's a card to play yet, and here it comes, for even as we glance fearfully seaward to watch the Spanish galleons standing in, ports up, guns out, stately grandees pacing the poop, linstocks smoking as their gunners prepare to sweep us all to blazes with langrel and canister, we're all took aback to see that there's summat amiss with the dons, huh? They veer, they yaw, their sails buckle, they bump into each other in confusion. Some of them are even caught in stays. And ashore, too, their troops give ground, gesticulating in dismay and starting to run in circles, while from the beleaguered buccaneers goes up a great ringing cheer. Headscarves are flung into the air, timbers are shivered, out come the baccy and rum flasks. Solomon Shafto dances above the sea-gate, skinny finger outflung to seaward. And Calico Jack stares long and hard, bright-eyed, before taking chin in hand and beckoning Bilbo and Firebeard aside. For yonder, coming up with the sunrise, the Union flag aflutter in the dawn breeze, and the strains of Rule Britannia sounding soft and steady across the track of the morning, a great double column of stately men-o'-war is ploughing over the sunlit sea, and from the erratic course they're steering, it can only be Admiral Lord Rooke and his fleet arriving in the nick of time. Aye, he got the show on the road after all, the stout old salt, and well pleased is he as he stumps his quarter-deck, scratches his grizzled head, and congratulates his sailing-master, Captain Yardley, on having navigated them so skilfully to Port Royal. It isn't quite the Jamaica coastline as he remembers it, but of course memory plays strange tricks. Seems to be a fire in the harbour, and a fair bit of Spanish shipping about. Odd, that.
"Firing salutes, too," he remarked approvingly, as smoke billowed from the guns of the nearest galleon. "Well, that's courteous. Damned careless, though," he added,
as a red-hot shot ploughed a smoking furrow in the deck and blew the stern rail to pieces. "You there, sir, Don, whatever the hell your name is," he bellowed at the approaching Spanish ships. "Don't you know to take the ghoulies out to the guns before ye exchange compliments? We might have taken a mischief." His protest was lost in a crashing broadside, which battered his flagship from stem to stern. The Spaniards, recovering from their momentary confusion at the sight of the British fleet, had seen that a quick, sneaky Castilian strike was imperative, and quickly turning their vessels round, were advancing to battle with guns blazing and trumpets sounding, silver sails agleam, red and gold banners streaming, and their commanders hurriedly quaffing last-minute cups of Malaga and wiping their mustachios. Promptly the British tars sprang to action with cries of "Belike!" and "You see!" urged on by their commanders, and none more stentorian than Admiral Rooke, as he blinked at the shambles of his poop, stepped smartly aside to avoid a falling mizzenmast, and demanded thunderously, "Damn you, Yardley, are you sure that's Port Royal?" Equally prompt was the action ashore, as the two mighty fleets met with crashing broadsides and billowing smoke, in which they searched vainly for each other for several hours. The contending parties on Octopus Rock reached an unspoken truce, each reasoning that there was no point in sweating away fighting when the issue was plainly going to be settled by the warships. So the Spaniards prudently withdrew to the castle, locking the doors and peering uneasily out of windows, while the pirates dug in on the beach with cries of, "Get your heads down! Let the Navy take the strain!" much to the disgust of Captain Avery, who protested furiously that while their countrymen were doing the dirty work, the least the pirates could do was line the water's edge and cheer. No one paid him a blind bit of notice. And while they are all thus gainfully occupied at Octopus Rock, let us take wing for just a moment far across the broad Atlantic and see what was happening on that very day in far-off, peaceful old England, whence we weighed anchor so many pages ago. Master Samuel Pepys sat in his fine office at the Admiralty, massaging his aching head and deciding that he didn't feel at all well. Last night had been bad enough. He'd been bored stiff admiring Mr. Evelyn's collection of pressed leaves and listening to his ghastly poetry. And then he'd been unwise enough to sit up late with Captain Cook, drunk as a dog, hearing some juicy scandal about Lady Robinson. And this morning, when he felt fit for nothing beyond quietly recording those events in his diary, had come this appalling little stranger, bearing big trouble, the evidence of which was spread on the secretary's table. He stole another uneasy glance and shuddered. Yes, they were still there, six colored sketches of six priceless jewels, opal, sapphire, pearl, diamond, emerald, and ruby, each depicted in a gem-encrusted cross of solid gold. "Whence?" croaked Master Pepys unsteadily. "Had ye these?" "Would you believe," asked Vladimir Mackintosh Grunbaum earnestly, "that them pictures was delivered anonymous at my lodgings, with instructions to bring em to your good self?" "No," snapped Pepys, "I wouldn't. And let me tell thee, sirrah, whosoever thou art, that if I order thy arrest on suspicion of possessing stolen goods, to wit, the Madagascar crown from which these sketches were made, it shall avail thee naught to tell my Lord Jeffreys it fell off the back of a sedan chair. He's heard that one before." "Haven't we all?" chuckled Vladimir, no whit abashed. "So let's get practical, for I see, Master Secretary, that you're not one to beat about. So we ain't bugged here, are we? No coos with ear trumpets at the panelling? Good, good. Can't be too careful. Well, now, twixt ourselves, I might be able to lay hands on the originals, those six pieces of the Madagascar crown which was so misfortunately lost as a result of Admiralty negligence, but which have now been recovered thanks to the sterling efforts of my client, Captain Benjamin Avery, R.N.
"Avery?"
"Sterling fiddlesticks!" yelped Pepys. "Gad's life, he'd lost the damn thing in the first place!"
"Through no fault of his own," countered Vladimir promptly. "Consider the facts. It wasn't Captain Avery's bright idea to have this priceless diadem entrusted to a single messenger, albeit a distinguished officer, without proper escort, was it? It wasn't his fault that the crew of the 12 Apostles, a king's ship, mind, included some of the bloodiest buccaneers that ever wrung salt water out of their socks, was it? It wasn't his fault the ship was hijacked by pirates, was it? And it wasn't his fault the Crown was betrayed by one Colonel T. Blood, who is not only a well-known jewel snitcher, but is also," Vladimir tapped his bulbous nose knowingly, "a former acquaintance of a certain royal personage who is always notoriously short of cash." Vladimir shook his unkempt head solemnly. "Admiralty negligence, did I say? Some might have another word for it, mightn't they?" Master Pepys discovered that his head was aching worse than ever, and that he was starting to sweat most uncomfortably. "But fret not," continued Vladimir smoothly. "My client has instructed me to restore the jewels as an earnest of his unremitting zeal for his Majesty's service, which he continues to do, incidentally, by ridding the western seas of the pirate scourge, for which I doubt not he shall presently receive rich reward and fulsome honour from said Majesty. He's going to be front-page stuff," added Vladimir impressively, "my boy is." Master Pepys fought for speech.
But why, then, have ye not brought the Madagascar crown itself, stead of these trumpery drawings?"
"Well," Vladimir pursed his lips judiciously, "I had to take precautions, didn't I? And it did occur to me that you might like the jewels returned private-like, without embarrassing publicity. I mean," he leered confidentially, "we wouldn't want the facts I mentioned just now to become common gossip, would we? If they did, well, at best the Admiralty'd get egg all over its face, and at worst," he sighed anxiously, "there could be an hell of a scandal reflecting even on your good self, to say nothing of the geezer with the long wig and the spaniels. Oh, we know it was all just bad luck and coincidence, but malicious tongues being what they are, anyways, I thought you might like the jewels back confidential, no questions asked. Worth everyone's while, I should think." He blinked and beamed greasily. Ha, thought Pepys, blackmail. And this oily little knave was right. It could look like some infernally complicated plot, especially with that rascal Blood involved. The king's honor, Pepys' own reputation. He gulped and glared at Vladimir. "Did Avery put you up to this?"
"Perish forbid!" exclaimed the Fink indignantly. "What kind of clients do you think I got? Between ourselves, he wouldn't care for this one bit, decent lad that he is, but," he smirked virtuously, "I got to do my best on his behalf, ain't I?"
Master Pepys ground his teeth. "How much?" he demanded.
"Well, now," Vladimir settled himself comfortably, "there ought to be a knighthood, right? And a civil list pension, say, 2,000 a year, and the deeds to a nice little property, oh, somewheres about Chelsea or Richmond. Yes, that'd be favourite."
Master Pepys took a deep breath. "You'll want it in writing, I suppose," he grated. "Aye, very well."
"Good, right," said Vladimir contentedly. "That's me taken care of. Now for my boy."
His boy at that moment was having an incredulous confrontation with Colonel Blood on the beach at Octopus Rock.
"Locked in the what?"
"In the bathroom," snapped Blood.
"My sweet Vanity, confined in Spanish closet," cried Avery in anguish. "Nay, 'tis fiendish refinement or cruelty, even for dagoes, to prison a tender maid in their foul tropic convenience."
"She wasn't prisoned," said Blood, who seemed to be in a bad temper, "according to a fat little greaser who was trying to crawl up the ventilator shaft.
She had took refuge when Lardo and his gang besieged her bedroom with intent to ravish her and Donna Mellifluo. Hell of a mess. Blood and setting lotion all over the shop. Fortunately, he added carelessly, I was in the vicinity and dealt with Lardo and his rascals. Och, there were four or five of them. But you know my old style. Back to the wall, give him the old imbricata, 1-2.
But Lardo, man, what to him?
Blood shrugged. I just defenestrated him. Avery went pale, wincing.
Gad, but you're ruthless. Will he recover?
From 200 feet up. Are you kidding? He didn't even bounce. But for all the thanks I got, Blood went on bitterly, I might have saved my labor. For what says my Lady Vanity when I knocked on the privy door with the tidings that I had braved all hazards to win to her side, demolishing Dago's right and left? Did she even say thank you? Did she, hellas like? Where's my bin? Were her first words as she issued forth. Downstairs, says I, giving his well-known impression of Louis Hayward, with never a thought for your sweet self, but fret not, Acushla. I'm here, your faithful Tom, to rescue you and lay me heart at your feet. Did she swoon gratefully on my breast, though? She did not. Heavens, says she, he mustn't see me like this. I'll have to change. Oh, look at my hair. And is he well? How's he looking? Ah, but how thoughtful of him to send you ahead, Colonel. So like him, dear considerate Ben. And me with ensanguined blade, and my shirt thrust through in four places. Women! The colonel snorted with disgust and fell to sulky brooding. Avery's spirits had rocketed at this recital, but now he laid a sympathetic hand on the colonel's shoulder. What else did you expect? He wondered. Some fellows have it, some have not. I have, you hadn't. That's all there is to it. But she is safe and awaits me in the castle yonder. Nay, I'm afire to hasten to her, and shall presently, once Rook has got the lead out of his pants and come ashore. What's keeping him? For things had been moving while we've been away with Pepys and Vladimir. The great sea battle between Rook's squadron and the Dons has run its inevitable course, and if we didn't show it to you in full, well, we have to keep an eye on the budget, and you don't miss much anyway. The fact is, they blazed away all day in blinding smoke, only to find, after it had cleared, that they had been facing in opposite directions, wasting their shot on empty water, at which point the Spanish admiral had come to his senses, realizing that since he didn't outnumber the British 53-1, he was in a position of historical futility, with nothing for it but to strike his colours, his forehead, and his subordinates before surrendering, with courtly foreign grace, to a bewildered Lord Rook, whose annoyance at being hundreds of miles off course vanished when he discovered how opportune had been his accidental arrival at Octopus Rock. The Don's capitulation had been the signal for a corresponding armistice ashore, where the Spanish garrison had mooched out sullenly from the castle with rather grubby white flags. Avery had received their surrender and set them to tidying up under the buccaneer's direction while he hastened down to the beach to welcome Rook ashore in the big reunion scene. This was somewhat delayed, since his lordship was still in a state of confusion after his unlooked-for victory, with his great cabin full of bowing grandees offering him their swords and demanding separate berths as prisoners of war, and Captain Yardley at his elbow protesting that it wasn't his fault they'd strayed off course. It was these blasted Admiralty charts, do you see? And he'd always said they should never have gone metric. Meanwhile, Captain Avery, all eagerness to report to his superior, waits on the beach, where we have just seen Blood bringing him up to date on events in the castle. For it's been such a busy day, what with sea battles to watch and surrenders to receive, that conscientious Ben hasn't had a minute not even to seek out his lady fair. Now, reassured that she is in good shape, he is feeling pretty bobbish, unlike Blood, who is cheesed off to yonder. They stand side by side in the gathering tropic dusk, looking out across the dark waters towards the British and Spanish ships, still sorting themselves out after their battle, wrapping up their sails and trying to find their anchors. Over in the harbour, the exploded Spanish ships have burned themselves out, the captured garrison
have been locked up for the night with their tacos and tortillas in the castle outbuildings, and the weary buccaneers appear to be settling down at a respectful distance to a little light rum and music round their campfires. The soft strains of a chanty drift on the warm evening air. The moon is rising like a silver ghost. And suddenly we realize that this is the finale coming up, for 'tis all over, looky. Aye, virtue has triumphed at last. Villainy has been given the heave. Rook will be falling headlong ashore any minute, full of bonhomie and congratulations. The pirates will get their pardons for services rendered, and e'en now Vanity in the castle is putting the last touches to her makeup for the moment when she and handsome Ben will hasten to each other's arms in slow motion to a thunderous crescendo of violins. And that'll be it. No wonder Avery wears an expression of smug nobility, a pleased smile touching his chiseled lips, hand elegantly rested on placid rapier hilt. Even his ruffles stir complacently in the night breeze. "I tell thee what, Colonel," he observes contentedly. "I'm feeling not bad. Who says all doth not come up roses? Here's mission accomplished, duty done, honour restored, sweet Vanity to be claimed presently. Young Mellifluer delivered, Lardo clobbered. Pity I didn't fix his wagon personally, but you seem to have done a competent job. Spanish devil refoiled, our settlement saved, the coast brethren under wraps, and a golden future ahead. I wish I knew where that blighter Mackintosh Grunbaum has got to," he added, frowning. Little does he guess. "But that's a trifle, and shall not mar my merited satisfaction."
"Hippoo bloody ray," grunted Moody Tom. "Fine for some. What's in it for me, after all I've been through, eh? Who saved Mellifluer? Slipped it to Lardo, and looked after your hoity-toity piece, will you tell me? But you finish up with the girl the credit, and the profit divil a doubt. Great. Congratulations."
"Little beef hast thou," retorted Avery warmly. "After the way you carried on, renegading, chickening out, betraying, making passes, and generally behaving like rascal stinkered. All right, ye've done some service," reluctantly, "but let me point out that as anti-hero, you ought by rights to be stiff and stark at this stage of the story."
"Burn your impudence," cried indignant Tom. "Who says so?"
"You know perfectly well," said Avery, coldly, "that you should have perished in the final assault, making proper amends for sundry villainies, struck down by a chance shot, say, or stabbed in the back by someone like Sheba in a fit of passion. By the way, I haven't seen her since we landed, have you?"
"No, and it can stay that way."
"Odd that," frowned Avery. "I'd have thought she and the other pirate rogues would have been sidling up by now, knuckling their foreheads and reminding me about their pardons. However, yes, Blood, by all the cannons, you should have bought your deserved lot and died in my arms, making repentance in tones right piteous, smiling last rueful smile and begging me to take the news to your dear old mother in Wicklow."
"Galway, rot ye!"
"Naturally, I'd have forgiven you, and said I could have spared a better man, although I can't think of one offhand. And doubtless ere Vanity and I walked off into the sunset, she'd have been soft enough to drop something on your grave. A glove, an old hair grip, a tear, even. As it is," said Avery censoriously, "since you hadn't the decency to die in character, here you are, all in one inconvenient piece, and we'll just have to make the best of it, I suppose."
"Right, that did it," roared Blood, and yanked out his sword in a fury. "I just about had it up to here with you, Captain Benjamin Smartass. Aye, with you and your 6'2", a nose in the air, park-sauntering, blow-waved, ruffle-shirted, public-school pince-nez and graces. I should have blitzed you on the 12 Apostles, or on Dead Man's Chest, when I was sentimental mug enough to take pity on your Dartmouth College ignorance, so I was. So I should have died, eh? Right, me bucko, here's your chance. Pluck out your iron."
"Frenzy," snapped Avery. Rodomontade, middle age spread. Oh, I'll give you middle age permanent. On guard, you great long streak of wind and water. He flourished furiously. Oh, calm down and be careful with that thing. Nervous, are you? Here's the cure, then. Draw your gallery playing jackanapes, or do you need a female audience to show off to? Is that it? Sneered the raging colonel. Show off? Cried Avery, stung. Nay, now you've gone too far. On your head be it, then. And he whipped out his rapier, meeting Blood's lunge. The blades clanged. Is this where Blood finishes up a la Rathbone, you ask, with the surf washing through his curls? Not a bit. A few passes, and Avery had jumped back, lowering his point in angry disdain. Oh, pack it up, quo' he. This is just too silly for words. I can't fight you. Not at this stage of the game.
Oho, crowed Blood. And why not, huh? Pangs of conscience is at it. Because you know you'd never have got this far without me, eh?
Nothing of the sort. It's just that, well, for one thing, suppose there was a sequel, you'd have to be in it, wouldn't you? And what the blazes do you want? Can't you see we're busy?
This last was addressed to a small, fat figure in prisoner-of-war garb, who had come scampering down the beach and was now cringing obsequiously at Avery's elbow. It was Enchilada, doing a Uriah Heep. Avery glared sternly.
"You're Spanish. Why aren't you in prison?" he demanded,
and the oily chamberlain fawned nervously.
"Please, excellent heretic, senor, I got parole honest. The big pirate in the white threads, he give me this."
He held out a sealed note.
"And say I must bring it to you at moonrise, not before."
As Avery took the paper, puzzled, Enchilada scuttled away, and Blood, curiosity getting the better of his recent anger, came forward for a peek.
"From Rackham?" frowned Avery. "Nay, what should this be?"
"Probably a loyal address to the hero of the hour," said Blood sarcastically, "or a whip round to send Firebeard to university. What's it say?"
Avery broke the seal, turned the paper to the moonlight, and read aloud the following: "To Captain Ben Avery, R.N. we all dispatch, honored sir and comrado. We want no pardons, nor ever did. We sailed with you for our own purposes only, viz., that in taking Octopus Rock and o'erthrowing the Dons, so we might come to possession of Lardo his great treasure, the which was pirate monies in the first place, so are we entitled. Think it not amiss that we look to our own profit, and trust not to the Admiral's bounty to reward us fittingly. Heard ye ever o' Ben Gunn, that was with Flint and John Silver, and Billy Bones and Hans and Mary and others of the pirate brig Walrus, that buried a great booty on a certain island, whereto in later years came sundry gentlefolk, and digged up the booty which was not theirs, surely. Yet they enjoyed it and had rich use of it, while Silver and his fellows, that had been at the pains of earning it, got naught, saving a pittance to poor Ben Gunn that the gentries gave him as 'twere a dole or charity. Now was this just, think ye? But 'tis ever the way. So we think to mend our own fortunes as chance serves, nor trust to no pardons, and if ye look presently o'er the loom of the land, shalt see us at our sailing. Come not against us, King's man, for we go south of the setting sun to those other islands farther on. But get ye to your lady, and to that fame and fortune which we doubt not ye shall find. Adios, camarado, and when the sun is over the foreyard, forget not thy foes. Signed this night, we're all good fellowship and be damned. Jonathan Rackham, James Bilbo the Black, Firebeard his mark, the Chevalier H.D. Pugh and the company. Postscriptum. We claim the pardon for our comrade Sheba, what sails not with us, having some enterprise of her own." A strange keening noise, like a deflating football, issued from Captain Avery.
He stared at the missive, at Blood, and finally up towards the sea gate where the buccaneers had been singing round their fires. The fires still twinkled in the dusk, but all was silent, save for the Spanish prisoners snoring and champing in their lockups. Avery clutched his head. "The bounders!" he cried. "Oh, the ingrate, forsworn rotters! After all I've done for them! Why, dash it, Blood, they're just a gang of thieving pirates! That's 2 million quids worth of government prize money they're pinching, not just any old loot. Well, they're not getting away with it. Come on!" He legged it along the beach and up onto a small headland, where he could look clear across the harbor to the open sea beyond. And as he gazed, with Blood panting at his elbow, out from the lee of grim Octopus Rock a tall ship was gliding over the moonlit water, with creak of cordage and distant sound of triumphant revelry. Hang it, he could even hear Firebeard blundering about, "Har, har!" and Goliath's shrill piping voice and a babble of French irregular verbs, and Solomon Shafto gibbering crazily a drippin' unlimited. And on the poop, unless his straining eyes deceived him, an elegant, black-coated figure, do you see, and another massive in calico white. And as the vessel heeled under the night wind that filled her sails, the tumult and cheering were blending into such a song as the Brotherhood sang when they went down to the sea, a sinful, ranting chorus by the powers, all about dollars spinning and drinking at an inn, and dying in their boots like old bold mates a Harry Morgan, and laying on board and board, and swimming in rum to kingdom come, a godforsaken wanton singing, and ye may lay to that.
"'Tis the Santa Umbriago, right enough," cried Blood, "Don Lardo's great treasure ship, with a fortune in her hold."
"Those blighters," quo Avery, gritting from incisors to molars, "will be singing another tune presently, and it won't be happy days are here again, I warrant ye. Run out on me, and a royal pardon will they. We'll see about that. What shall I not hunt them down wheresoe'er they venture, and bring all to book and chance it?"
He was interrupted by a hand laid on his arm.
"Easy, boy," said Colonel Blood. "Prithee hold on but a moment. You'll mind," said he weightily, "that on dead man's chest I said I'd stand by ye and see ye through the wickedness of the world, with sound advice and good counsel."
"Ha! We know what came of that. First crack out of the box you were chummying up to my betrothed, and oozing off with Akbar's cross, and—"
"Tut, tut," reproved Blood. "Mere trifles. This is your Uncle Tom talking, for your own good, and I'm telling you."
He nodded in the direction of the treasure ship, standing now out to the open sea.
"Let him be. Forget it. Not because 'twould be perilous pursuit, or revenge too dearly bought, but just for your own peace of mind hereafter. Never mind what we were debating a minute since, whether I'd been of service to ye or not, that's no matter. But ask yourself," and he looked our hero in the eye, "where would ye have been without them?" He nodded again towards the Santa Umbriago. "Not on Octopus Rock and all well." Avery blinked, and a thoughtful frown crossed his handsome features. Conflicting emotions traded punches in his finely tuned brain. He glanced at the distant ship and gave a sharp intake of breath as a faint "har, har!" floated across the water. He sighed heavily, but what he would have said we'll never know. For at that moment a silvery soprano was calling his name, and he was wheeling around like a pointing gun-dog to gaze enraptured towards the castle. There she was, framed in the gateway, a shining vision in cloth of silver, blonde hair elegantly shampooed and set. She'd had all day to get glamoured up, and had made the most of it. Now, as her sparkling eyes discerned the distant figure of her lover, her voice tinkled again like a crystal chandelier in a high wind. "Ben, ah, Ben, darling, where on earth have you been? See, 'tis I, thy Vanity."
"Vanity!" Avery's ecstatic baritone quivered with longing. "My own! Hang on, beloved, I'll be right."
"Capitan Ben!
"'Ah, it is you indeed, cœur mio, it is I, Mellifluo, you have come back for me!'
Avery, on his mark and about to bound towards the castle gate, checked as though hit by three wing forwards. From a sally-port in the castle wall, hidden from Vanity, a small and dainty figure was tripping down a flight of stone steps, waving as she came. Even at that distance, he could see the love-light suffusing the face of the beauteous little Hidalga. But there was more to come.
Barracuda!
The throaty, exultant contralto throbbed through the tropic evening, and he turned in disbelief to see a magnificent figure in a leopard-skin track suit sashaying across the rocks. Sheba always kept a spare leopard-skin tracksuit in the secret passage for just such emergencies as this. Beneath her plumed picture hat, he could see the brilliant gleam of teeth as she strode towards the little hill on which he stood.
Barracuda, at last!
Captain Avery did a stricken triple take of the gorgeous trio advancing on him from different directions. By his calculation, if he stood rooted, which seemed likely, they ought to arrive simultaneously in approximately 60 seconds. Hero that he was, his classic features went distinctly pale.
"Oh, Lord," he said.
"As you said yourself," murmured Blood sardonically, "some fellows have it, some han't. Ah, and the best of British, brother."
"Blood!" Avery seized his arm. "Tom, don't go. I need thy sound advice and good counsel. What am I going to do? I mean, most embarrassing. What'll I say? You're a man of the world, Tom, old chap. Couldn't you take at least one of them off my hands, dash it all? Not Vanity, obviously, but..."
"The trouble is," said Blood apologetically, "I don't speak Spanish all that well. And as for Black Beauty..." He shivered. "Besides, I've had this fancy to slip down to Roatan and pay me respects to Mistress Bonnie. More of my style, d'ye see?" He patted the distraught captain on the shoulder. "Sorry, old joy, but you're on your own this time. Tom Blood bids ye good luck and good-bye."
"Recreant!" cried Avery. "Ha! False to the last!"
He braced himself, took a deep breath, and turned with dauntless bearing to meet them. Arms outspread to Vanity, a glad smile on his lips. Perhaps if he pretended the other two weren't there. Colonel Blood walked down the hill towards the beach, whistling softly to himself. One backward glance he took as the sound of female voices carried down to him, and then he was striding across the sands, and far out on the shining sea, the tall ship was standing away down the moon's track, with all her canvas spread, and very faintly across the water he could hear the pirates singing, "Farewell and adieu to you, fine Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu to you, ladies of Spain." And for all I know, they may be singing still.